This is a summary of The Law Says What? By bestbookbriefings.com. The Law Says What? Stuff You Didn't Know About the Law, But Really Should. By Mac Len Stanley. Thinking Like a Lawyer. The goal of this book is to introduce you to the strange and interesting things about the law that you don't know about, but really should. We will be touching on topics that relate to everyday life, and many of them may infuriate you. Whenever we encounter a law that seems unjust, or against common sense, it's important to understand the logic behind it. Lawmakers hardly ever seek to make the world more unfair. Another goal of this book is to show you how to think like a lawyer. We don't intend to bombard you with minor legal details, but instead, we hope to present the big picture of the foundations of the law. Along the way, we will question and examine it to see why it has evolved to be what it is today, and how it is actually applied. Ultimately, the author hopes to fundamentally change the way that you think and interact with the law. You may find that once you learn from this book, you will see how prevalent the law is in your own life. Section 1: The Police. The police don't have to protect you. Generally speaking, no one is legally obliged to protect anyone else. If someone fell into a river and was eaten by a hungry alligator, you might have a moral duty to help them, but if you just sat there and watched, you would face zero legal repercussions. What you might not know is that the same rule applies to the police. There are many cases of police failing to provide some much-needed assistance to citizens. These people took the police to court, but found that the court ruled in the negligent police's favor. However, the existence of a special relationship changes things. These exist when one individual can exert a degree of control over another, like a parent to a child, or a landlord to a tenant. If a special relationship can be established, the person in question can be held responsible. Unfortunately, courts can be very reluctant to establish a special relationship between the police and citizens, unless the police have specifically done something to cause an individual to rely on them. Why don't the police have a duty to protect you? Pragmatically speaking, creating a chain of direct accountability between the police and community would be the catalyst for an avalanche of lawsuits from any victim of a crime. Even if most of these lawsuits were immediately dismissed, the amount of time and money spent considering the rest would be disastrous, especially for local governments. The standard of the special relationship aims to strike a balance between total immunity for police inaction and absolute accountability. F. The police, the First Amendment flipping the bird, or showing the middle finger, is one of the most common insults in the United States. Some people choose to express this insult toward police officers, but a recent federal case has ruled that police cannot retaliate in response. To do so would violate their First Amendment rights. What is the First Amendment? It protects a person's freedom of expression, whether it be through speech, gestures, religion, or peaceful protest. However, it doesn't give you a free pass to say anything you want, whenever you want. The First Amendment doesn't cover things like defamation, true threats of violence, incitement of lawlessness and violence, stealing other people's speeches, or obscenity. It's also crucial to note that the First Amendment only keeps the government from placing these restrictions on public citizens. Private businesses and individuals have free rein to ban whatever kind of speech that they like. The police don't always need a warrant. The Fourth Amendment protects citizens from unreasonable searches and seizures by any agent of the government, including the police. In order to undertake any such action, along with arrests, a warrant must be issued by a judge, after satisfactory evidence is provided to support a probable cause. Let's take a look at some of the exceptions to this important rule. Arrest warrants. Successful criminal investigations usually end with a formal warrant for someone's arrest. But while this is the preferred method, it's not the only option. In fact, it's not even the most common one. Most arrests are performed out in the field, with no time to even contact a judge. Police are allowed to skip this process if they have probable cause. But while this is an extremely important legal term, it doesn't have a clear definition. Generally speaking, it lands in a gray zone that is subject to the police officer's reason, experience, and discretion. Warrantless arrests cannot be made inside a person's home, but there are exceptions to this rule. If police are in active pursuit of a target, they don't have to stop just because the suspect flees into their home. If they believe that the suspect might pose a danger to someone inside the home, they can enter. A person with legal authority over the residence can also provide consent for them to enter, but this doesn't include landlords or hotel managers. Search warrants. Many exceptions have undercut the government's requirement for a search warrant. Police are allowed to search the premises of a place if they believe that evidence is in danger of being destroyed. They can also conduct a search of any item that is within plain view or out in the open. The protections of the Fourth Amendment only apply to persons, houses, papers, and effects, which means that open and undeveloped fields are plausibly unprotected. Similarly, the restrictions around vehicle searches are also more relaxed. Drug-sniffing dogs can provide probable cause, and as such can be used to search during traffic stops, provided that the traffic stop is not unduly delayed. Section 2. Crime and Punishment. I thought she was 18. So what? So far, we have taken a look at some very gray areas of the law, but now we'll take a look at a kind of legal liability that is totally black and white, the question of guilt. When it comes to strict liability offenses, your guilt is dependent on one thing alone: did you do it? If so, you're guilty. But most crimes don't fall under that category. They require a specific mental state to go along with the actual criminal act. Mens rea, guilty mind, in Latin, is the state of mind that is required to convict someone of a crime. Simply put, your brain must be as responsible for your actions as your body. Mens rea is usually organized into four hierarchies of ascending relevance: acting with negligence, acting recklessly, acting with knowledge, and acting on a purpose. Mens rea is a critically important part of the law. It's what distinguishes murder from manslaughter, and it's often the turning point of a trial. One of the few exceptions to this requirement is statutory rape, which is generally defined as sex with a person who is below the legal age to consent. Many states classify it as a strict liability offense, which means that the convicted person's knowledge or intentions are irrelevant to their guilt, full stop, with no exceptions. Why is this the case? Lawmakers aim to protect children and teenagers in enforcing this liability. Many of them have articulated their beliefs about the significant potential physical and social harms of sexual activity among this demographic. By placing the risk of error on the offender, the hope is that any malicious predators are deterred. Statutory rape laws vary by state, from things like the age of consent to how important a reasonable mistake may be to the conviction. This is because the United States operates under a system of government called federalism, which makes it so that there are two layers of power within the same territory. The federal government is responsible for the broad governing of large nationwide issues, while each state has its own independent government for its own concerns. While federal law is held to be superior to state law, federal law only applies to a limited number of areas. As a result, state governments have a significant amount of power, and different states will have different demographics and cultures, hence different laws. Gun laws are another good example of how state laws can vary widely. The vast majority of criminal prosecutions in the United States occur within state courts, about 30 million per year, in comparison to 1 million per year in federal courts. Federal prosecutions are usually much more involved than state cases. When a prosecution happens, it usually means that the federal government is ready to put the full weight of the United States behind the case, along with its people and resources. Murder without killing, the felony murder doctrine. Felony murder is when someone commits a certain kind of felony that is inherently dangerous, and someone else dies in the course of committing it. If this is the case, any offender who was involved can be charged with murder, regardless of if the death was accidental or the offender did the killing themselves. There are real-world cases where a burglar has been convicted of murder after the owner of the home he broke into died of a heart attack. The mens rea is totally ignored. All that matters is that death occurred during the felony. Felony murder is one of the most controversial aspects of American criminal law. It is the only developed country in the world that still enforces it. One justification for this doctrine is that it serves as a deterrent for dangerous felonies. It is also rationalized as supporting the unique sanctity of human life. By definition, a felony that results in the loss of human life is more serious than one that doesn't, and as such, requires more severe punishment. While these reasons might not seem up to par for many people, the felony doctrine has been instrumental in prosecuting unjust killings that would otherwise have been much harder to deliver a verdict on, such as with the George Floyd case. Marijuana, legal and illegal. Despite the rapidly increasing support to legalize marijuana at the state level, it is still considered illegal under federal law. In fact, under the Controlled Substance Act, it's treated as one of the most dangerous substances on the planet. The vast majority of scholars and commentators view this as an unjustified and outdated stance on the substance. Alongside influential criminal penalties for its possession and usage, its status under the CSA also highly restricts any scientific research around it. Why is this the case? Proponents for restricting it argue that there is insufficient evidence of marijuana's medical value, and more that supports its harmful and addictive effects. However, pro-marijuana activists would argue otherwise. The restriction on marijuana can be best explained by the political dynamics that were present at the time of the CSA's founding. Many American politicians were concerned that unregulated use would lead to societal problems. Racism was doubtless an underpinning of this sensationalized concern, as the majority of users at the time were Black and Hispanic. The government can take your stuff. Civil forfeiture makes it so that the police are allowed to seize property that they have probable cause to believe is being used for criminal activity. Once the property is seized, a civil lawsuit is taken against that property in order to take official possession of it. In most civil forfeiture cases, the forfeited property goes to the police department that seized it. In fact, more than half of all police departments now heavily depend on the revenue that comes from these forfeitures for funding. There is very little accountability regarding how these properties are spent, so there are many reports of them being used for the personal use of the police. Many lawmakers have begun to question the validity of civil forfeiture, with many states requiring a criminal conviction first or outlawing it entirely. Some states have passed laws that require the proceeds of the forfeiture to go towards the state's general funding. But the federal government's equitable sharing program makes it so that the police still hold on to the majority of the property that they seize. In spite of these problematic practices, civil forfeiture laws were actually made with positive intentions and were historically supported by both parties. Civil forfeitures have worked as a powerful weapon to counter the influx of foreign drug money and drug smuggling activities into the United States. In some cases with international criminals, civil forfeiture can be the only way to prosecute them and attain some measure of justice. Section 3, Self-Defense. Before you can shoot someone, you need to be really, really scared. Self-defense laws were created based on the rational concept that you have a right to protect yourself. The specifics of self-defense laws vary for each state, but generally speaking, it's legal if your actions fulfill each of these four categories. 1. Imminent danger. Self-defense must be enacted in response to an imminent threat, some harm that is about to occur right now, not sometime in the future. 2. Provocation. Self-defense does not apply if you initiated the fight that became a threat to your safety, unless the other person responds with excessive force, or if you withdraw and the other person persists. 3. Proportionate force. The amount of force you use to defend yourself must be proportional to the danger you are trying to avoid. 4. Reasonable belief. Your belief that you were being threatened, and that self-defense was necessary, is instrumental to your claims. Whether or not you had a reasonable belief is something that is traditionally decided by a jury, a cross-section of the community who is often asked to place themselves in the same position and ask, "What would I have done?" In order to use deadly force in self-defense, you must reasonably believe that you are facing an immediate threat of great bodily harm or death. In Florida, deadly force is also permitted in order to prevent a forcible felony like treason, murder, arson, etc. Texas is the only state that allows for deadly force in order to protect property, but only at night. Some states require you to attempt to retreat before you are allowed to use deadly force, but other states have stand your ground laws, which allow for deadly force, so long as the individual in question is in a place where they are legally entitled to be. Florida was the first state to pass a law like this in 2005, and today more than half of all states have followed suit. Almost every state has adopted a castle doctrine, which provides special rights for deadly force against an intruder in your home. Some states have greater legal protections than others, and the definition of home can vary from just houses and apartments to vehicles, sheds, and boats. Section 4. Your rights. Abortions are about privacy. Many of you have already heard about the Roe v. Wade case, which is about the constitutional right to have an abortion. What you might not know is that the constitutional right that protects it is the right to privacy, which prevents the government from being involved in a woman's choice. But if you've read the Constitution, you'll note that there's just one little problem: it says nothing about privacy. The Supreme Court argues that many explicitly stated rights in the Constitution form other rights that aren't mentioned. The Ninth Amendment specifically states that the enumeration of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or diminish other rights, and so on. The Constitution's implication of a right to privacy has been used to affect many important cases in history, like the right for married couples to use contraceptives inside their own homes. Some commentators feel that this justification is appropriate, but others feel like the right to privacy is an absurd fiction created in order to justify the court's personal opinions. What might happen if the Roe v. Wade case is overturned? The power to legalize or outlaw abortion would return to individual states, but it would not make them automatically illegal throughout the country. Congress might eventually step in to pass a law to determine the right to an abortion, but public opinion is split as to whether or not that's a good idea. You can steal someone's land, and keep it too. Under the doctrine of adverse possessions, trespassers can come onto land, occupy it, and eventually become their legal owners. Every state has its own specific requirements for gaining ownership, but courts will generally look at four factors. 1. Knowledge that the land they are occupying belongs to someone else. 2. An active presence on the land, as if they are already owning and maintaining it. 3. Open and obvious occupation of the land to the public. 4. Exclusive and continuous possession of the land. Adverse possession is supported by the use it or lose it philosophy. Land is a very valuable asset, and it's always better for someone to be using it, rather than no one. It's because the property is so valuable that it can be taken away from you. It's also important to mention the concept of eminent domain, or the power of the government to take private property and convert it into public use, like highways or utility lines. However, the Fifth Amendment makes it so that they can't just do this at will. The Takings Clause states that private property can only be taken for public purposes, and the landowner must be compensated for their land. 1 Wyoming vote equals 4 California votes. Some people see the Electoral College as an ingenious and forward-thinking mechanism that was created by the Founding Fathers. Others see it as representative of a system that is disenfranchising and discriminatory. Over the past few decades, millions of dollars have been spent on initiatives to abolish it. So what is the Electoral College? It's not a popular vote system, where each citizen gets one vote, and the candidate with the most votes wins the election. That's how it's done in most republics and democracies, but not in America. Under the Electoral College system, each state is given a certain number of electoral delegates, who each get one electoral vote. The number of delegates a state receives depends on how many Congress members they have. There are 535 members of Congress, 100 senators, 2 for each state, and 435 House representatives. The overall number of congressional members is set, but the number of representatives that each state can have fluctuates pretty regularly. This is because it depends on the population that is recorded in the national census, which is taken every decade. More populated states get more members in the House. Illinois, for example, has 18 representatives, while Alaska only has 1. Because every state has at least 1 member in the House of Representatives, and 2 senators, that means they get at least 3 electoral votes. States use a popular vote to determine who their delegates vote for. If a candidate gets the majority of a state's vote, all of their electoral votes go towards that person. This makes it so that it doesn't matter how many votes a candidate gets, only how many states they have a majority vote in. Part of the controversy around the Electoral College, along with how it invalidates the popular vote, is that all states, no matter how small, receive at least 3 electoral votes. This means that less populated states like Wyoming have votes that are quantifiably worth 4 times as much as votes in California do. It's worth noting that many of these smaller states have mostly white populations, while larger states tend to be more diverse. It's important to remember that the Founding Fathers were colonists who were fleeing a tyrannical monarchy. They put a lot of thought into avoiding any system where any single individual could gain too much power. The fear with a popular vote was that Americans across a large and still developing nation would not be equally equipped with the knowledge to make an informed choice. It's worth noting that southern states were particularly opposed, since a significant portion of the population were slaves, and thus could not vote. This issue was infamously resolved by having enslaved individuals count as 3/5 of a free person, for the purposes of state representation. It's unlikely that this system is going to change anytime soon. Abolishing it would require a constitutional amendment that was approved by 2/3 of Congress and 3/4 of the states. Swing states in particular stand to benefit from the current system and are unlikely to cooperate. Section 5. Employers and landlords. Punch a guy in the face at work? It's your boss's fault. Respondeat superior is a type of legal liability that means that someone is liable for the harm that someone else causes. This type of vicarious applies to parents for their children and employers for their employees. There are some ground rules. The employee must commit the act while accomplishing some kind of work for their employer, not while pursuing their own interests. Harm can be caused in the line of negligence, defamation, assault, or the intentional infliction of emotional distress, etc. While this might seem unfair to any individual employer, lawmakers have decided that generally speaking, employers as a whole are in a better position to compensate the victims than the guilty employees. Employers can purchase liability insurance, which is offset by the prices that they charge for their products and services. In a way, respondeat superior can be seen as just another business cost. The police don't have to protect you, but landlords do. Landlords are responsible for the safety of their tenants. They have a special relationship where they have control over the security that they provide. This doesn't mean that landlords are liable for every crime that takes place within their property. Their duty is to protect based on what is reasonable for their property's specific circumstances, and any negligence on their part is seen as a failure. The warranty of habitability also requires landlords to keep their property in a satisfactory legal condition. This warranty is legally applied in every rental agreement, even if no explicit promises are made. Today, many states have set out their specific definitions for what habitable means. California in particular has one of the most expansive standards, from an adequate number of trash cans to working electrical outlets. However, this doctrine has drawn some controversy. Supporters argue that it protects vulnerable tenants from potential abusive landlords, but opponents claim that it drives up the price of rent and encourages landlords to abandon older buildings in poorer neighborhoods. A court system without lawyers. The small claims court is the champion for equal and accessible justice. The playing fields are leveled, the little guy can take on a company, two neighbors can settle their disputes, and ambiguous contracts can be settled. As it happens, the small claims court is where the majority of all employer-employee and landlord-tenant legal disputes happen. It's not for everyone, it's designed to handle minor disputes, where the money involved falls below a certain threshold, usually between $2,500 to $10,000. The rationale is that smaller disputes don't necessitate the usage of the very complex and time-consuming normal court. For accessibility's sake, the traditional rules of evidence and procedure are relaxed in small claims court. Parties usually just need to bring copies of the relevant evidence and hand it right to the judge. If witnesses are asked to, they can be questioned without that many limitations. Small claims court has no jury, the judge has the full authority to decide every aspect, and they generally do what makes the most sense for the specific case, even if it means setting aside some formalities of the law. Despite this, small claims court is still a genuine court, with real-world consequences. The judgments rendered in them are official and fully enforceable. Lawyers tend to mock the small claims system, looking down on it as the little league of law. In many states, lawyers are forbidden from representing clients in small claims court, or even observing the proceedings at all. The rationale is simple: attorneys are too complicated. Any party with a lawyer would be at a significant advantage, and besides which, the amount of money that is involved is rarely large enough to justify a lawyer's fee. Section 6. The court system, the bias of the jury selection process. The jury is a paradox often praised for its wisdom and ability to seek the truth, but lawyers caution their clients against ever involving them in their case, as they are an unknown, unpredictable element. It's hard to overstate how much lawyers seek to avoid dealing with juries. Around 95% of all criminal cases are resolved by plea bargains. While there are many reasons behind this statistic, there is a significant fear of progressing the case to the point where a jury is involved, as it means increasing the stakes of the punishment, or the payoff. The law has reacted with strong regulations that aim to control who gets to sit on a jury. The aim has always been to eliminate any biases, but the real-world application can leave something to be desired. Voir dire is the term that describes the jury selection process. During voir dire, lawyers on both sides will question prospective jurors to see if they are biased regarding the case at hand. A juror cannot have any previous knowledge of the case, a relationship with any of the related parties, a related occupation, previous personal similar experience, etc. Unique problems come up when jurors are selected for high-profile cases that have received significant attention from the public. Large portions of society have already formed their opinions on the case based on what they've seen for themselves, so confirmation bias can weigh heavily on their decisions. In cases that have become popular throughout the nation or even the world, the jury selection process struggles to adapt. If an attorney's questioning reveals some bias in a prospective juror, they can be removed, for cause, at the judge's discretion. You might consider intentionally declaring some form of bias to get out of jury duty, but it's best to remember that jurors are under oath during voir dire and that judges are very familiar with all the usual tricks of getting out of it. Lying under oath or perjury is a criminal offense that can land you in jail. Additionally, parties can use something called a peremptory challenge to exclude any potential juror for no reason at all. Removals for cause are unlimited, but each party is only allowed a certain number of peremptory challenges, depending on the jurisdiction and case type. Significant strategy is involved in deciding when to use them, and who on. But it has been criticized for several reasons, specifically for its potential to discriminate based on race. Cities with large black populations would have large proportions of black jurors, but this hasn't been the case for decades. Peremptory challenges often strike out black jurors, especially when black people are defendants. Prosecutors are motivated to pursue this by the stereotype that black individuals are often biased against the criminal justice system. With that said, white individuals have been accused of their own biases, too. Generally speaking, jurors tend to have a bias towards defendants who look like themselves. Overall, voir dire is generally used to gain an advantage in the trial, instead of impartiality. After all, lawyers want to win. A reflection of ourselves, the human element of law. People often speak of the law as if it's a part of the natural order of the world. This isn't the case. Human beings have thought of the law they created and enforce it every day. If you've ever met a human being, you'll know that we're prone to being emotional, hypocritical, self-serving, and overall weird individuals. As much as we like to uphold its sanctity, the law will always be a reflection of ourselves. Every aspect of the law requires human input and intervention, from legislators to police officers, from jurors to attorneys and judges. By that same logic, it's only through human action that unfair laws can be repealed or revised. Everyone has the power to influence the law, even if it's indirectly. We can prompt our representatives to act through votes or social reforms, and in some cases, we can campaign to change the law ourselves. Perhaps in the future, computer algorithms will eliminate the need for the human element in the legal system. Machine learning and AI may analyze the evidence and come up with the best, most fair conclusion. Or maybe the law will remain connected to humanity. Can any computer program be advanced enough to deal with the gray that fills the law, or practice discretion? Should grayness and discretion even be a part of what our justice is? Human nature is imperfect. Discretion will always be a way for bias to inundate our legal system. How do we combat it? No one knows for sure. As you encounter legal discussions, ask yourself why the law is the way that it is, and how human nature might affect the way it is implemented or influences the real world. Is it applied differently across different states? How might it evolve in the future? Whether you prefer to read or listen, we have something for you. Visit bestbookbriefings.com now for more summaries.